because I knew she had a lot of people directly impacted that she could bring with her.
Mm-hmm. In the last 20 seconds, the expansion of these ICE detention centers that you have been fighting all over the country.
Yep. I mean, they want to pop up everywhere. It's just literal warehouses of human suffering. And I'm afraid for this country. I'm afraid for the constituents in my community because he is locking up citizens. And the process to get them out is costly, expensive, and is tearing our communities apart.
Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva, I want to thank you so much for being with us, the first Latina to represent Arizona in Congress. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Now I'm tired of segregation, and now I want my equal rights. Well, respect and education, well, not total integration. Now that's why I'm fighting for my rights.
I am Don Jacobson, one of the hosts of Moving On Friday, from noon to 1:30. This Friday, I'm presenting music of the Civil Rights Movement and related music. From the Montgomery High School Trio to Rhiannon Giddens, we'll hear music that supported and inspired social movement. At a time when the federal government is hacking away at diversity, at KBOO, we are embracing it. Tune in Friday, noon to 1:30, only on KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Community College faculty and staff are ready to strike.
An ICE agent in Portland gets bullied by a kid on a bike.
And Trump's State of the Union speech gets fact-checked.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Josh Salem. Over 2,000 faculty and workers at Portland Community College could strike on March 10th. 94% of unionized workers voted to authorize the labor stoppage. The two unions prepared to strike are the Federation of Faculty and Academic Professionals and the Federation of Classified Employees. It would be the first time in the college's history that both unions could strike at the same time. The unions and the college have been negotiating over wages and benefits, but their talks stalled in January. Merrill DePasquale is a union member and an administrative assistant at the Rock Creek campus. DePasquale described the sticking points in their negotiations on this week's episode of Labor Radio.
It's the COLA. The cost of living adjustment has been a huge sticking point. I think that management's first response and their first offer that they came in with was 0.25%. And it was just insulting and shockingly low, especially with consumer price index hovering around 3%, the inflation that we've all been seeing and feeling. And then after negotiations had kind of crawled on, they were like, oh, well, we'll raise it to 0.35%, as if that was a big adjustment. Our members are feeling very disrespected by that. And then management has also been stalling and delaying bargaining, and their offer does not include retroactive pay. So it kind of rewards them for the delays that they've put into the process.
Laura Wadlin is a union instructor at Rock Creek. Wadlin says the college has been making cuts in the wrong places.
Members are extremely concerned about the cuts to classes and the closure of extremely popular programs. You may have heard about the Music and Sonic Arts program, which is a nationally renowned program for people to get into the music industry. It's not just like music theory or orchestral music. It's to be a sound tech or do the behind the scenes stuff at a concert or something. And this is extremely well enrolled, totally beloved by students, and the college just decided to cut it. And they have no explanation for why. Multimedia, the program that does video production, they're very worried based on class cuts that they might be next on the chopping block. Courses in English, art, math have been very reduced for the next terms. Offerings are reduced, even for classes that are historically extremely well enrolled. These are revenue generating classes that students need to go on to their specific certificate or associate's degree that they're working towards. In fact, one of the most egregious examples is that there were 500 students waitlisted for Writing 121. Writing 121 is like the basic need to have English course in college. So many people have to take this course to even like move on to the next thing at all. And those 500 students who were waitlisted for it, could have run dozens of classes, were turned away. And who knows what happened to them? Maybe they just stopped trying to rely on PCC for an education. Maybe they decided to just not seek an education at all. Maybe they went to a different institution. We don't know. We've lost them. And again, PCC just doesn't have an explanation for these things.
That was Laura Wadlin, an instructor at PCC Rock Creek. She's also a monthly host on Labor Radio. The president of the PCC faculty union, Ben Cushing, says the college has been making irresponsible financial decisions. The union says that since 2018, the number of managers at PCC has grown by almost a third. PCC faculty and staff aren't the only education workers on the brink of a strike. Classified staff at Central Oregon Community College could strike the first week of April. And Lane Community College faculty signed strike pledges as their mediation continues. Classified staff at Klamath Falls City Schools pledged their willingness to strike over their less than $16 an hour wage. Teachers at Centennial Public Schools in Gresham also indicated their willingness to strike.
Last October, an ICE officer called Portland's 911 dispatch to say a kid was tailing his unmarked Ford Explorer on a motorized bicycle. The agent threatened to take matters into his own hands if 911 dispatch didn't send Portland officers to assist. As the ICE agent and the young person approached Northeast 82nd Avenue, the agent opened his center console and pulled out his service weapon. The ICE agent, identified as Israel D. Hernandez, told Portland 911 dispatch, quote, "I need someone here now, or else I'm going to have to shoot this kid," end quote. Hernandez did not open fire. The kid, who Hernandez described as being in his late teens or early 20s, ended when the kid dropped the bike and fled on foot. The kid was not identified in either Portland Police or ICE's records. OPB reported when they called the telephone number released in the 911 records, a person picked up the phone and said, "Hernandez," but ended the call abruptly once the OPB reporter identified themselves. Concerned about violence committed by federal immigration officers have been particularly high in recent months. A group of teens had been stopped at gunpoint by ICE officers at a local coffee shop in Hillsboro in early October. Then in January, two people in Portland were shot and wounded by U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents, and two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis were shot and killed by ICE officers. When he called 911 One dispatch, the ICE agent said, quote, "Some kid is punching my window, and I need assistance right now." When 911 dispatch said, "Why would someone want to punch Hernandez's window?" he said, "Well, because I work for ICE, I guess." Hernandez went on to say, "I'm going to have to act on this kid right now," end quote. The dispatcher encouraged Hernandez to get away safely by driving somewhere highly populated. At one point, as Hernandez said he was going to exit the vehicle, the dispatcher interjected, quote, "Why? You can drive away. Have officers en route to you. I don't want you guys getting into any more of a dispute," end quote.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said yesterday that data centers' impact on Oregon is not sustainable at the current growth rate due to the industry's massive consumption of water, energy, and other community resources. Kotek said, quote, "Oregonians have made their concerns about rising utility bills clear. As our state faces rapid growth of data facilities, we must have frank conversations about the challenges and opportunities ahead," end quote. However, the governor is the chief force behind House Bill 4084, which she calls a prosperity roadmap that is currently being considered by the legislature. The bill would extend property tax relief for data centers, for which Oregon is already one of the most generous states, from 5 years to 10. This would create an estimated $4.5 billion decrease in local revenues. In January, the governor formed a data center advisory committee, which is expected to present policy recommendations in the fall of 2026, which could lead to legislation in next year's session. In a press release, Kotek and state lawmakers will use the recommendations to create regulations, likely aimed at where data centers can be built. The regulations would focus on protecting energy infrastructure and water supplies from being overburdened by privately run data and AI processing centers, which use exceptionally large amounts of electricity to run and water for cooling. Oregon's data center market is one of the largest in the country, according to the Chicago-based commercial real estate group Cushman & Wakefield. Access to relatively clean, inexpensive hydroelectricity in the region and a lack of sales tax, along with billions of dollars in property tax incentives, have lured those companies to Oregon. The decision to offer those property tax incentives and to physically site a data center is made at the city and county level. As giant data complexes expanded across the state during the last several years, energy rates rose on all customer classes served by the state's private, investor-owned utilities. For residential customers, rates have gone up an average of 50% in the last 5 years.
The City of Bend will consider a policy proposal to implement a climate fee on natural gas equipment in residential homes. The intent is to reduce negative impacts of fossil fuel emissions and encourage electrification. Under the proposal, installing a gas furnace as part of an HVAC system in an average-sized Bend home would result in a fee between $1,800 and $4,500. A study from the Energy Trust of Oregon shows that from 2021 to 2023, 86% of newly constructed homes in Bend were built with natural gas heating. Bend City Councilor Mike Riley said, quote, We need to be really thinking about the impacts of climate change. The longer it takes us to reduce emissions, and especially to reduce our use of fossil fuel, the more likely we're going to have worst-case scenarios in the future, end quote. The fee revenue will go to a program to incentivize household electrification, likely in the form of rebates for electric appliances. Bend City Council will hear a presentation from Cascade Natural Gas, the city's gas utility company, on April 8th and could vote on whether or not to institute a new climate fee this summer. In 2025, the city of Ashland was the first city in the state to impose a fee on new natural gas hookups.
Donald Trump claims America has entered a golden age with his return to office. Former Vice President Pence says Trump economic policies are no better than a king's. And an investigation finds Epstein documents that discuss accusations against Trump are missing. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Members of Congress and my fellow Americans, Our nation is back, bigger, better, richer, and stronger than ever before.
In his State of the Union speech, President Donald Trump declared a golden age for the country, comparing his second term to the American Revolution. His speech aimed at former President Joe Biden, saying inflation and immigration are no longer problems. Trump also said that, quote, new energy partner Venezuela provided 80,000 barrels of oil to the U.S. In the House chamber, much of the president's normal rhetoric was greeted with the usual partisan divide. But polls show the president is currently unpopular. Only about a third of all voters, a quarter of independents, approve of the job he's doing. Trump is lagging even on issues he campaigned on, including the cost of living and immigration, and he's now facing questions about a possible conflict with Iran. Less than a week ago, the Supreme Court struck down his signature tariffs, and the president responded by imposing 15% global levies using a different legal path. It's not clear if Congress will back the new import taxes or if the administration will try to enforce them without that approval. Former Vice President Mike Pence says Trump's trade policies go against what the framers wrote into the Constitution.
When the founders ultimately crafted the form of government that's endured for 239 years, they said that the Congress, in Article 1, controls taxation, including imposts that are, it's what they called tariffs in the day.
While Trump insists his immigration crackdowns have reduced migrant crime, Democrats argue that's come at the cost of protesters shot by ICE officers, citizens being forcibly detained, and migrants deported without due process. Ryan Schwenk is a former assistant chief counsel for ICE. He says in the agency's rush to staff up, officer training on the law and the rights of civilians has been gutted.
Classes that teach the Constitution, our legal system, firearms training, the use of force, lawful arrests, proper detention, and the limits of officers' authority.
A new NPR report says the Justice Department may have hidden an estimated 50 pages of FBI files related to Jeffrey Epstein concerning an accusation against Trump. The Bureau apparently interviewed a woman four times who says at 13, Trump struck her and tried to force her to perform oral sex on him. Members of House Oversight say not releasing the FBI records may violate the Epstein Files Transparency Law, and before the State of the Union, Danny Bensky, an Epstein survivor, says there are other steps the administration must take.
First is the release of all of the files, which we know. Next is to hold accountable those who continuously exploit. And the third is to pass Virginia's bill. We need to pass Virginia's bill because justice should never, ever expire.
Named for Epstein abuse survivor Virginia Giuffre, the bill aims to prevent traffickers from escaping accountability, in part by ending the statute of limitations in civil sexual abuse cases. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, listen for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather: expect mostly cloudy conditions with an overnight low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly sunny conditions with an afternoon high of 53. Today in history, February 25th, 1870, Hiram Rhodes Revels became the first African-American sworn into the U.S. Congress. The quote of the day is from Phyllis Diller. She said, quote, "I want my children to have all of the things I couldn't afford. Then I want to move in with them," end quote.
The Wisconsin Counties Association has negotiated an agreement with Canadian energy company Enbridge. It involves the cost of policing protests expected with the construction of the company's Line 5 reroute. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The 30th Annual Alaska Native Art Auction, celebrating Indigenous artists and voices, takes place Saturday, March 21st at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage. Information available at knba.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian energy firm Enbridge will reimburse a northern Wisconsin county for the cost of policing protests expected with construction of the company's Line 5 reroute. As Danielle Kading reports, the Ashland County Board approved the deal Tuesday.
The Wisconsin Counties Association negotiated an agreement where Enbridge will reimburse local governments for public safety costs tied to the Line 5 project in northern Wisconsin. Funds will be deposited into an escrow account managed by the association. Some residents worried the deal would turn local authorities into a private security force. Bad River Tribal member Edith Leoso warned against signing the agreement to get reimbursed by Enbridge.
They will not be honest with you. They will feed you what you want to hear. And then they will take everything from this area and leave you to pick up the pieces.
An Enbridge spokesperson said the company volunteered to fund the account. Enbridge also said it received a final U.S. Army Corps permit that the company says will allow construction to move forward. But state approvals for the project are being challenged in court. Enbridge previously paid millions for public safety costs tied to protests of its Line 3 replacement project in Minnesota. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A civil lawsuit filed in Maricopa County Superior Court in Arizona alleges a factory on the Navajo Nation was, quote, squandering millions on improper and mysterious expenditures before suddenly shutting down in July. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
The Albuquerque-based firm, Indigenous Design Studio and Architecture, or IDSA, alleges that Mesa subcontractor Zenny Home breached its $50 million deal to build 160 modular homes.
There's a whole lot of money that got dumped into Zenny, and you know, obviously only to produce 18 homes. It's a mystery.
Attorney Jay Curtis says IDSA is looking to repair the reputation of its founder, Tamara Begay, in addition to recouping roughly $22 million American Rescue Plan Act dollars for the Navajo Nation. Zenny Home CEO Bob Worsley says there won't be a refund of any amount.
No, the money's gone. It's not sitting in somebody's account somewhere. So the company has been liquidated. There's no more assets. It's just almost theater when we spent every dime they gave us, and about $4 million more than that out of my pocket. So, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Worsley also faces a separate federal class action lawsuit after laying off more than 200 employees last year. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Former Navajo Nation Vice President Rexley Jim is being remembered for his advocacy for Navajo people, including in education, culture, and as an international diplomat. Jim served as vice president from 2011 to 2015 with Navajo President Ben Shelley. He also served on the Navajo Council, was a poet, playwright, author, and traditional medicine man. The Navajo Nation Council said he passed away on Tuesday and recognized his dedication to Navajo people, cultural preservation, and global indigenous advocacy. Former Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, Joanne Chase, is being remembered for strengthening NCAI's national presence and advocating for Native rights. Chase Mandan Hidatsa Narikara served as Executive Director from 1994 to 2001. In a statement Tuesday, NCAI said of Chase's passing that her leadership helped the organization become stronger and more visible, working with tribal leaders, Congress, and others. She later worked in philanthropy, policy, and arts, including most recently serving as vice chair of the board for the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Donald Trump got fact-checked during his State of the Union speech by a long list of fact-checking services last night. In the nearly two-hour-long talk, Trump tried heavily to convince potential voters the economy is roaring and that deportations are focused on criminals. His accuracy varied widely. Trump's overall claim that he inherited a nation in crisis, then achieved a turnaround for the ages, was false. Inflation had already fallen to 3% when Trump took office, and also was not at the highest levels ever seen by Americans. Crime rates had been falling as well, while the national homicide rate for 2025 will probably settle at the lowest rate ever recorded. At 4.0 per 100,000 residents, the rate for 2024 was only 5.0 per 100,000 residents, according to official FBI data. Trump claimed the military was having trouble recruiting before he took office. Though rates did fall short of recruitment goals in the 2022-23 fiscal years, the Army, Air Force, and Marines all exceeded their recruitment goals in the 2024 fiscal year, which ended in September, more than a month before his election. Trump claimed the U.S. added 70,000 new construction jobs in just a very short period of time, but this statement was exaggerated. According to Associated Builders and Contractors, the construction industry added just 14,000 jobs in 2025. Builders have generally struggled because of the cost of building components has been rising because of Trump's tariffs on metal imports. Trump said, quote, in 1 year, we have lifted 2.4 million Americans, a record, off food stamps, while the number of people who receive benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program did decline by 2.6 million from November 2024 to November 2025. That decrease does not correlate exactly to decreased need. The lower numbers in November 2025 came during a government shutdown when food stamp benefits were severely disrupted. In fact, Trump's tax and domestic policy proposals also reduced eligibility and cut federal spending on food stamps. Trump repeatedly talked about immigration, saying, quote, after 4 years in which millions and millions of illegal aliens poured across our borders, totally unvetted and unchecked, we now have the strongest and most secure border in American history by far. In the past 9 months, zero illegal aliens have been admitted to the United States, end quote. He is right that a record number of migrants crossed the border illegally during the Biden administration. However, many were detained at the border by authorities and then released with a notice to appear in court. The Trump administration did successfully drive illegal crossings down to the lowest level seen in decades, and Border Patrol recorded just over 6,000 illegal crossings at the U.S.-Mexico border in January alone. Trump claimed he had passed the largest tax cuts in American history last year. In fact, the tax cut and domestic policy package Trump signed into law last summer ranks as the sixth largest ever. Trump seemed proud that, quote, we will always protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, end quote. However, his signature tax and domestic policy bill passed last summer made more than $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid over the next decade, the largest reduction in the program's history. And a substantial share of the savings is expected to come through pushing more than 10 million people out of the program through more stringent eligibility checks. Trump even exaggerated the number of shots on goal stopped by the gold medal winning hockey team. Some services fact-checked the Democratic response to Trump's remarks. In general, figures and opinions offered by Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger were felt to be more accurate.
A new report by an environmental group has found the Springerville Generating Station in Arizona to be past its prime. Operators are converting it to a natural gas facility, but scientists say that's not the best use for a plant in the Sonoran Desert, where there's a prime opportunity to create large amounts of solar power. Mark Moran has more on the story.
A coalition of three Arizona utility companies has elected to stop burning coal at the Springerville Generating Station in southeast Arizona. The coal-fired power plant is transitioning to natural gas, despite scientists warning against relying on gas as a long-term source of energy. A new report by the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says maintenance costs at Springerville are just one of the reasons that the plant is no longer viable. The Institute's Dennis Wamstead says it's outlived its usefulness.
Coal as a resource may have been that in the past, and it is no longer that going forward. It is too expensive, it is too unreliable, and it is too polluting to rely on going forward.
The Springerville closure is the latest in a series of coal plants to close. Four others in the Mountain West were shut down last year. Other plants in the West are also transitioning to natural gas, but Wamstead warns that cost, availability, and infrastructure demands don't make that a viable option in the future. He says there's a more obvious energy source available in the Sonoran Desert.
The reality is, in a place like Arizona, Arizona's utilities should be building solar as fast as they possibly can. It is the cheapest resource by far. Arizona is by far the most solar radiant state in the U.S. and can generate huge amounts of solar power.
Wamstead adds that a pro-coal political climate makes transitioning away from it more difficult. The Trump administration has said it is trying to make the U.S. more energy independent by reinvesting in coal. I'm Mark Moran for Arizona News Connection.
New Hampshire Governor Kelly Ayotte says the Trump administration has canceled plans to convert a Merrimack warehouse into an Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facility. Local activists are celebrating the announcement, but say people are still being wrongly detained throughout the state. Comments from Grace Kindeka, Director of Projects New Hampshire, Center for Justice and Equity. Catherine Carley has more on the story.
New Hampshire activists are celebrating the federal government's decision not to pursue an ICE detention facility in the state. Governor Kelly Ayotte made the announcement after what she says were productive discussions with the Department of Homeland Security, which had plans to convert an industrial warehouse in Merrimack into a regional processing center with up to 600 beds. Grace Kindeki with the New Hampshire Center for Justice and Equity says she's proud of the local residents who pushed back.
When we say we don't want these facilities, we don't want concentration camps in our backyard, we absolutely mean it, and we will make sure that they do not continue to operate.
Documents show the warehouse was part of DHS's $38 billion master plan to grow detention capacity to more than 92,000 people nationwide. It is the only New England location listed in ICE's expanded detention model. Opposition to the Merrimack facility began in December after Governor Ayotte and local officials said they were unaware of ICE's plans in the state. Multiple protests ensued as residents raised concerns over lost tax revenue and environmental impacts, along with the health and safety of those inside. Kindeki says while she's pleased the protests worked, people are still being wrongly detained.
This energy and this win really just powers us up from the next round of struggle that we have to continue to be in, because our people and our loved ones are still being taken. They're still being disappeared into the system.
New Hampshire is the only New England state where local law enforcement has signed formal agreements to engage in immigration enforcement. At least 13 agencies and the state police are now authorized